and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we talk mid-century modern in the perhaps unlikely furniture capital of Melbourne.
They wanted to contribute something that was going to make the world a better place. It was that kind of utopian, idealistic approach, but it was very much at the core of the practice of quite a number of these designers.
And we head to Fire Island to meet the studio that's helped create an architectural identity for the seaside town.
You know, we do things in a very simplistic, minimalist fashion, like almost a Japanese planning concept, and then we try to like play with the light and manipulate the light as the sun travels from east to west.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Let's start close to home, editorially speaking at least. As Monocle's summer newspaper, Mediterranean has just gone to print. Our fifth in the annual series covers everything from Portugal's search and rescue squad, tourism in Tunisia, and especially for our Section D listeners, a profile of a Milanese modernist holiday mecca built in the 1950s and 60s on the Ligurian coast. To discuss this sunshine special, I'm joined by Rich Spencer-Powell, Monocle's creative director. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start with an overarching view of Mediterranean. We've been doing it for about 5 years now.
Yeah, it's creeping up there. This is issue 9. Of course, the winter one is Alpino, so it kind of you get one Medi-year and one Alpino. But in total, we're by the end of this year, we'll have done 10. So, yep, correct, 5 years. And it's kind of got into a nice rhythm. Traditionally, it's something that the art director of Monocle gets to have control of. I kind of take a little bit of a backseat. Old man Rich gets to put his slippers on, put his feet up, kind of. So some credit to art director Emin Chu and designer Jay Yeo. I've got some things to show you. I thought I'd kick off with a bit of
It's as the printers as we speak, but yeah, let's flip through some of these runoffs here.
It's a bit of a treat. We've got an actual running sheet, which is effectively the actual cover that was sent over from a printer. So you can see it actually to size, because Med and Alpino are both oversized, so you can't actually see them to scale when they're printed out. Here we have a nice bit of Pantone for you, Tom.
Oh,
a pastel fluoro.
My favourite.
I think it's, I'm probably wrong, but I think it's Pantone 924. It's okay. A rare one. And it's a very, very bright pastel yellow. So it's the first time we've used it. So I always get excited when a new chip gets torn out of the book. I know Jackie, our production coordinator, likes it as well.
And the picture edit, I mean, it's always the same sort of feeling. There's always usually a half-naked man. Images of seaside towns, and how do you go about that? Sort of make sure people are aware about what this newspaper is actually about.
Well, I think covers have to do various things. I mean, they have to sell, so they have to be bright. And I think when it comes to Med, it's quite a niche theme. And I think what you want to do is, with the picture selection and with the design, is you want to encapsulate that feeling of summer. And so, of course, that is torsos and trunks and surf and eating outdoors and sunlight and things that are drenched in sunshine. And I think you want to get people to look at it and think, I want to be there, I want to go away, I want to pick that up, and I want to get on the first flight out of here, well, particularly this weather, and hit the Med. You know, I think it's a popular destination. It's kind of a very endearing place, I think.
Yeah. And let's go inside the newspaper, and let's talk first about a brand new venture for Monocle, which is, we've got A to B, E sections we've had for years, but now we're moving to F, which is fiction.
Yes, well, it's new, so we should big it up. But I think it's important to know that this came out of, I think perhaps we've done too many essays, and the thought of doing another 10 essays was a bit like, oh, what else can we write? So the editor, actually, Andrew, had a good idea to do a bit of holiday fiction. It's a murder mystery from a Greek author. And it's just like one long, I think it's about 5,000 words. It's a good big old read. It's quite interesting.
It's the longest story I think we've...
It is the longest.
By far we've ever published.
It is. I mean, but probably by three times the length, actually. Yeah. I think probably previously it was only sort of 2,000 words. So it's nice and indulgent. But I think, you know, Med is supposed to be taken on holiday and read around the pool. And I think a good murder mystery is quite entertaining. We broke in a new illustrator as well, Spanish. So from the Med, Alexi Nola. Nice, simple styles. Done quite a bit for the New Yorker, which I think is quite key, I think.
It's a good model to base on, isn't it?
Yeah, and you think, if you think about those layouts and the copy lengths, particularly in New Yorker, they are long reads. And so, yeah, it's a new one for the readers, so I think it's going to be popular. I think we'll do it again, actually. I think everyone quite enjoyed the freshness of that approach.
What's the working process when you do this? I mean, how sort of hand in pocket is the illustrator with the writer?
In this case, we were given a synopsis and actually some suggestions from the writer. And those suggestions were things like characters that may occur,
yeah.
little clues to the plot. But of course, you have to keep the illustrations quite abstract because you can kind of give the game away quite quickly. And as it's meant to be a mystery, you know, you don't really want to see the death scene in image one. So we just kind of kept them at distance, actually. I think otherwise the illustrator can kind of give away too much information.
And tell the story too much. You want the reader to let
yeah.
them use their imagination, sort of.
And I think you want to be intrigued a little bit. So we've got some kind of mysterious characters on the page and some nice quotes. And it kind of gets you in there.
And from long, long stories to, let's move on to the fashion, which is, we're sort of looking onto autumn, winter now, isn't it?
Yes. And it's always difficult to shoot autumn, winter when it's the middle of summer. So we always kind of call it light autumn. So it's kind of like you can still be wearing a shirt, but you might have a, you know, a cardi on or, you know, a jumper over the shoulder. And this approach was kind of based on T-shirts and saying that a T-shirt doesn't necessarily just have to be for summer. You can actually wear them into winter, and to kind of to warm up, you can put a T-shirt underneath the shirt and then have the shirt open and loose. And then you can kind of pair that with a cardi or, you know, you can have a heavier trouser, that kind of thing. So. And again, interesting, a new photographer for us, Devin Blair, who has kind of been on our eye for a while. He came in several times over the last year. We've never quite found the right vehicle for him. This, we think, was perfect for him. So it's very light, white, airy studio shoot.
Mm.
Very clean, minimal palette, just right for him. And when that brief is so set for someone, it just makes your job easy. You kind of turn up at the studio and let them do their thing and just wait for the results. And the results are really good. I think it's the nicest
yeah.
med fashion we've done for a couple of issues, I think.
Because the pictures do go incredibly large compared yeah. to the magazine. And, you know, this...
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun to have that extra real estate to play with. Because the pictures go so big, you can have a lot of impact. But also you can, in this case, we've kind of chopped everything up and layered everything with multiple imaging. But, of course, they still go big enough to read. They're still yeah. almost like quarter pages for Monocle. So... It's a lot of freedom there. In fact, that's the one layout I really did get my hands on because it was such a plum one, so I took it.
Fun one to do. And I don't know if it's your favourite story in the newspaper, but it's certainly, to me, apart from the ones in my section, one of the most visually powerful.
Yeah, I think so. This is the culture story, the main story in culture, and it's about the open-air cinema culture in Greece, which still exists. And it's a very lovely, charming story, and... our culture editor, Rob, went and did the story, and our in-house photographer, Anna Cuba, went and shot it. And, you know, it's a good assignment, and she did an amazing job, and credit to her. And these pictures just have such life, you know. It makes you want to go to the cinema. It makes you want to go to Greece. It makes you want to be with your family and friends.
Mm.
It's just charming, you know. Every frame is charming. There's lovely light. And
it's quite difficult, considering, you know, cinema, people are sat still, looking at a moving screen, which is, you know, notoriously difficult to photograph.
It is, but I suppose if you're watching a film, it can bring out your emotion. And there's a great opening scene in a Woody Allen film, Play It Again, Sam, when he's watching Casablanca and the end credits roll. And as it rolls, the whole opening sequence is focused on his face, and you just see the lights reflecting in his very famous glasses, and you see a sort of change of expression. And I think actually people don't realize what they're doing with their faces and their bodies when they're sat watching things, because you switch off, you know. You feel like you're in isolation, but you probably are actually smiling or laughing harder than, you know, than you realize, or crying, depending on what you're watching.
Yeah.
So I think actually it's just, like, to repeat myself, charming. It just has a total charm to it.
It really is. It's one of those sort of lovely, sort of happy stories from the Med, which is why this newspaper's so fun to do and
yeah.
important to do as well.
And, you know, it's always a good sign when the writer and the photographer come back and they're, like, you know, full of beans about where they've just been. You just know that that will be translated into the photos and the words as well. So it's a little standout piece.
Rich, thank you very much for joining us for Section D. Scandinavia and North America usually dominate the imagination of mid-century modern lovers. But there's one region that is often unfairly overlooked, Australia. After the Second World War, the country was home to a slew of innovative designers that were determined to change the way that furniture was made down under. Today, their work holds up against many of their Northern Hemisphere contemporaries. This craftsmanship is currently the subject of a new exhibition at the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne. Monocle's Adrian Craddock recently received a tour of mid-century modern Australian furniture design from its curator Kirsty Grant, who explained the stories behind some of the exhibition's most iconic pieces.
In terms of furniture design in Australia pre the Second World War, it It's not to say that it didn't exist, but it was a very limited field. But another of the reasons why this exhibition starts where it does after the war is that it's a moment when the profession of the industrial designer is coming to the fore. There's real drive and real energy for this new profession. And I think we've come out of a war. Before that, there's a depression. And people needed furniture. There were soldiers that had come back from the war. They're setting up house. There was a market for it, a demand.
And I guess there's a sense of optimism after the war as well that they, I guess, tapped into.
Yeah, that's right. A real optimism. And I guess amongst designers also a sense that they wanted to improve people's lives. You know, that you read a lot about the sort of philosophy of some of these designers, and they did, particularly those who were working immediately post-war, they wanted to contribute something that was going to make the world a better place. It was that kind of utopian, idealistic approach, but it was very much at the core of the practice of quite a number of these designers. If you look, you know, there are a couple of pieces here designed by Fred Ward. He recognised after the war that there were all these soldiers coming back who were setting up house and who didn't have a lot of money and who couldn't furnish their houses easily. So he designed a series of, or a range of pieces of furniture that could be made by your average home handyman without a lot of skill or experience required, and you would write away to a magazine or a newspaper and get essentially a paper pattern, just like a dress pattern, then take it to the timber yard, get the pieces of timber cut and put it together yourself.
It's still a fairly elaborate design, I guess you could say. It's not stripped back.
No, that's right. And obviously there would have been cushions because it was it's a DIY piece of furniture. We decided to exhibit it without the upholstered cushions. But yeah, it was an example of good, simple, functional design. And I suspect it was a little pared back because, you know, Ward knew that people who didn't have experience would be making these things.
Can you talk us through the pieces on the left here?
This is a selection of chairs designed by Grant Featherston.
It's fair to say he's probably one of Australia's most celebrated designers, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And he's probably, I think, of all of the designers represented in this show, if there's one who's likely to be a household name, it's Grant Featherston. Mm. I mean, there's a wonderful quote that we use here on the wall. Neil Clarahan, an architect of this period, wrote that in the 50s, if you didn't have a pair of Featherston chairs in front of your bagged brick fireplace, you didn't have the modern home, you know? And so they just became characteristic of the ultimate modern interior. But I think this chair, which is the first model to come out in what he called the contour range, came out in 1951. For me, this is probably the most iconic chair within this exhibition. It's sort of come to symbolise everything about furniture design and even everything about life in this period in Australia. The story goes that he was playing with a tram ticket in 1950 and sort of bending it and folding it, and then suddenly realised that the way that he could form the shell of a chair was to cut out two pieces of plywood and basically slot them together so he could create a beautiful curved form. We've got Robin Boyd, the great modernist architect, talking here, and he was a real, I think, arbiter of style in Melbourne, particularly in the 40s, 50s and 60s, and this is an excerpt from a program on the ABC called Design in Australia, and this is just the episode on interiors, and he talks about a number of the furniture designers in this show, a number of the textile designers as well, but he was wonderfully opinionated and firm in his ideas.
What was his background? How did he come to assume that position as this real arbiter of style?
He was an architect, very important architect. In fact, came from a family who very significant in the visual arts as well. As we said, the community was very small. He was very well educated and believed that what he was doing and what his peers were doing in their work, their furniture design or their architectural work, that it was the way we should be going. And I don't know if he just took that role on. Perhaps there weren't others who competed against him, but you know, he wrote in the newspapers and he was very influential. He opened exhibitions, you know, he hosted programs like this, and you know, reading about the period, you just get a sense that again and again Boyd's opinion was quoted.
But certainly no other country exceeds Australia in the gaudiness and catchpenny gimmickry of so much of ordinary household equipment. Young couples setting out on married life choose the environment of their future from a market stuffed with over-styled, over-coloured, over-patterned little monster products of fashion. Of course, the young couple isn't forced to buy these things, but they've been taught no better, and they accept the jazzy colour and the chrome and the forced timber grain plastic as the mood and symbols of today. But no one could say that they love it.
I definitely remember this chair, at least in my old high school classroom.
Yeah. We're in looking at a display of chairs that were mass-produced in vast, vast numbers. So the Delma chair on the left is designed by Featherston in 1963 and produced by Aristock. And this is produced in quantities around 250,000. So this is what Featherston had was working towards. He wanted to make chairs that, or furniture that was functional, that used limited materials and that was able to be effectively produced in vast numbers. And he really achieved it with this chair. It's fascinating to me that when I was working on this exhibition, I really struggled to find one of these chairs that was in good enough condition for the exhibition. You know, that because they were so ubiquitous, they're not valued, they've all been turfed out. Mm. And then the chair on the right is another one known as the Integra chair, and it was designed by Charles Fury in 1973, manufactured by Siebel Furniture, and in fact has been in production until the beginning of this year in Australia, so an incredibly long run. And as you said, you know, this chair furnished schoolrooms all around the country. And interestingly enough, the machinery that is used to make this chair, and it was the world's first one-piece moulded polypropylene chair, so it kind of has a, you know, high honour in that regard as well. But polypropylene can't be broken and it can't be melted down, and so these are actually used also in prison seating. And so the machinery that makes these chairs has gone to America, and that's where they're going to continue to manufacture it, I think, for prisons but other purposes as well. So kind of fascinating, and it's the less glamorous end, I suppose, of design, but a really important element in the furniture story of this period.
All the pieces that we've seen before this have been so important to the projected image of Australian design in the 70s and 80s. I mean, did they really lay the groundwork for what was going to come next?
I think the success and the dynamism of this period and the work of these designers must have inspired the next generation. And I know, you know, even designers who are working today look back to this period and see it as something, or a time when something really significant took place in Australia.
Thanks, Adrian. Coming up after this short break, we'll talk beach home design in Fire Island.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
Welcome back to Section D. You're listening to me, Tom Morris. We cross over the Atlantic now to New York's Fire Island, a destination for beach lovers 5 miles out from Long Island's southern shore. The place is not just famous for its magnificent white beaches, but also beach houses and their beautiful architecture. Bromley Caldari Architects is a firm that has had significant input on what Fire Island looks like today. To this day, founder Scott Bromley and Jerry Caldari have over 70 finished projects under their belt in the area of Fire Island Pines alone. The founders showed Monocle's Marcus Hippie some of the projects they are particularly proud of, and the tour started with the house they call A-Frame Rethink. What the practice was initially given to work with was a building with an iconic 1960s A-frame form, but one that was in a worn state after having been beach rental for years. The architect duo gave the building a complete top-to-bottom renovation. Jerry Caldari explains.
So it was this A-frame structure, which was in fairly bad repair. Restored and fixed, repaired the structural elements of the house, put on a new metal roof, reclad the entire exterior of the house with cedar timber siding. We did a complete interior renovation and reorganized the spaces of the house by removing the central spiral stair and putting in a stair that flanked the house as it went up through bay windows. So pretty radical rethink. We touched everything in the house. We made all new bathrooms, bedrooms, kitchen, closets, living spaces. We put a new pool deck out there, all new windows. Basically, it's like a new house.
Shall we go in and take a look? So the ground floor and the main living space, Obi, how would you describe it and what are you most proud of?
staircase, right? I would have to say it's my partner, Scott Bromley. He's going to tell you about the staircase and how the principle of expanding these bay windows works.
This A-frame originally had a circular staircase in the middle blocking the view, plus it's now an illegal kind of staircase. It's not recommended to have a circular stair as the main stair in a house, right? Egress. So with making these bay windows, we were able to establish a staircase that wove its way through the house and up to the third level. So
I have to say, it's quite an impressive solution, and when you're standing on that part, by that window part, you can actually see the whole sea.
These are great windows, and it opened up the light in the place, because the only light was the north and south. And so now we've introduced light into the middle of the house, which just expands the space.
The windows were on the two flanking ends, the triangular ends, before we added these bay windows. And for tremendous views east-west. I mean, Fire Island's oriented east-west, so anytime you can look northeast, northwest or southeast, or northeast or southwest, you're going to get a longer, more expansive view of the water.
From A-Frame Rethink, our tour continued to see another project that was called Modern Ocean Abode. It was located right by the water and beach, as you can hear from the wind.
This is a great project. It was originally a Harry Bates house. Bates was very well known for putting the living room on the upstairs and the bedrooms underneath, so that you could either be in the trees or get a better view of the ocean.
And what then opens in front of you is an amazing, amazing view of the sea.
Yes, this Mother Atlantic is straight ahead. Fire Island itself is roughly 37 miles long, only between a half and three quarters of a mile wide. So this white sand and this incredible view. In fact, the neighbor was telling me today there were three whales out here this morning.
Indeed.
Yes.
Really. Right. What are your favorite features about this project when we look around over here?
Well, the fasteners are actually measured and patterned, and they actually are screws with washers. So there's nice detailing in the exterior of this house. There is foot baths for when you come in from the ocean to rinse off your off your thing. And the downstairs consists of a den, the hole that we walk through, a bathroom, and a bedroom.
Shall we go and check what's going on upstairs then? Well, what you get upstairs then is even a greater view.
Yes, the higher you are, the better you are, no pun intended.
And inside?
We completely opened it up, so there's a master bedroom, en suite with the bathroom, a powder room, and an open kitchen, and a dining and living space with, 11-foot ceilings. It's nice.
And then the bedroom.
So the bedroom has the little trick we did at the A-frame. It has a 2-foot bump out, which we slid the bed into, so now instead of the room being 10 feet wide, it's 12 feet wide. But it has the en suite bathroom that is really quite interesting, because it's the first bathroom ever designed only 4.5 feet wide. Most bathrooms have to be 5 feet wide. We did this in 4.5 feet. You have to enter into the second section, but here we have a tub that is right at a big window overlooking the ocean. And this is 3 feet for a toilet and 18 inches for a sink. How perfect. Plus a rain shower. We like that.
Time to continue the journey again. The third project of this tour was called Ocean View Complex.
We have a gentleman who bought the house that we're standing on, I guess 10 or 12 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. And as adjoining and adjacent properties have become available, he's purchased them, and we've incorporated those properties into an overall complex. So what we have in front of us is the main house, a swimming pool, dining deck, a screened pergola, a cabana building that has a bar in it and showers and all that for changing from the beach and the pool. And then additionally on the property, we built an octagonal dining pavilion, a screened pavilion. We built a small building for a gym. So there's a number of properties. They're all kind of connected with these wooden walkways. A lot of the brush and undergrowth has been pruned out so that it really feels like a park. You know, it's like heaven. This is such a nice compound, fronts onto the ocean. All the little houses, all the buildings have all kinds of nuance, and they're filled with little surprises, with clear stories and concealed doors and mitered corners. And the guys who built the house did a really great job with the wood craftsmanship.
Do you want to show me a couple of those special things over here?
You're looking at one, the pergola. The pergola screen and the little screened roof with the planters between it. Then we raised this deck here to make that covered dining area. The dining table was also built custom. We designed that table with cedar boards. There's a hot tub that's kind of like right in front of you, but you somehow don't see it. The cabana connects directly with the walk from the beach. So if you come up here and you're all sandy and stuff, there's a foot shower out here. There's an outdoor shower. Then inside we have a nice sink for cleaning up. There's tons of towels. There's a steam room and a shower. Big, you know, drinks machine, fill that with daiquiris. You got a party.
What else could you ask for?
Exactly, you know.
After the tour, it was time for the obvious question, how Bromley Kildare Architects had managed to snap so many projects on Fire Island. It's all about networking, it seems.
I think part of it is a social phenomenon. My partner is a very outgoing, very personable person. He's a very, very nice man. And it's a small community. We know everyone in the community. And it's kind of a go-to thing. There are probably three or four people out here working as architects. So there's enough to go around for everyone. And we've just been very fortunate in working here for over 20 years now that we've gotten so many very good projects with very good people.
Well, when I'm doing this interview, it's a very pleasant summer day, Saturday, on Fire Island. But it should be remembered that it's not always quite as nice. When you think of the winter, most of the people don't stay here. What does it take from the design process and from the buildings to actually make them last during in those harsh conditions?
Well, most of the construction takes place in the off season. So we're out here for the winter. We come out in January. I've been here in storms, been on the bay when the water's rocking. The hardest thing is Mother Nature. So if you notice, most of the projects are constructed with cedar. Cedar is fairly rot resistant. It ages well. It's fairly insect resistant. We use aluminum. Other than that, there's very few materials that will weather the storm. Even stainless steel starts to rust out here. Typically, it's kind of like a battle against nature. So we try to do good construction detailing. It has to be wind resistant. But the material really is the key, and it really is the cedar.
And when you think of your style and thinking of those 75 projects you've had on this island, do you notice a pattern over there? Do you have trademark designs?
Well, you know, I never thought we did, but a friend who came on the tour with us today said, you know, that everything was very orthogonal and rectilinear, and that there was some repeated ideas like the skylights above the rafters and the way that we modulate and allow light into an interior and how we control light. So I guess maybe that's the theme, is that, you know, we do things in a very simplistic, minimalist fashion, like almost a Japanese planning concept. And then we try to like play with the light and manipulate the light as the sun travels from east to west.
Well, Jerry, Fire Island keeps on developing and you see new buildings appearing that haven't been designed by you. What do you think about those other buildings?
Well, I like some of the other buildings. There's a lot of talented people in New York, and there's a lot of talent here on the island, and there's some very beautiful houses and some very beautiful spaces to be in out here. I like it all.
That was Jerry Kildare of Bromley Kildare Architects speaking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie on Fire Island. Coming up, Alan G. Brake of the Architects newspaper discusses the week's big stories in North America, and Section D producer Ala John will join us from Lisbon, where he's reporting on the new ideas underpinning City Hall's housing agenda. But now, how to improve the design of the world around us is, it's fair to say, a bit of a preoccupation for us here at Monocle. Well, one organisation has, for the best part of a century, taken up that very cause by awarding the very best in student design, aimed at improving the lives we lead through imagining the built environment around us. The Royal Society of the Arts here in London and their annual Student Awards have been awarding the best in new design, from toilets to bus shelters, from washing machines to turnstiles in underground train stations, for 90 years. Sevra Davis, Associate Director of Design at the Royal Society of Arts here in London, and also the manager of the Student Design Awards, joined Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound on this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly.
Just explain before we dive into the awards, there's so many institutions in London with Royal at the beginning and Arts at the end. Explain the history of your organisation.
Yes, of course. So I'm actually going to delve even deeper, which is that the full title is the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce. I think that title says it all to some degree. It's born out of the Enlightenment, but it's really thinking about how we can improve society using those three things. Arts, if you think about creative processes, manufacturers means that there's still a need that we make things and that there are tangible outputs. And finally, commerce is sort of how it all comes together and how things are brought to market.
But you kind of need that full title, because otherwise I imagine there's people knocking at your doors thinking they're going to see the odd Vermeer or Holbein or something, and it's not about that.
Yes, we're not the RCA, nor are we the Royal Academy, for any confusion.
Go away. But having said that, the RSPMDC is not an acronym.
We're neither Royal Sun Alliance either. Anyway.
Insurance company.
And has through the history, I mean, your design awards and through the history of the organisation as a whole, have they reflected that idea, that kind of leaning towards manufacturing, commerce, practicality of design rather than the ephemerality of it?
Absolutely. So the RSA, the Royal Society of the Arts, was founded in 1754. And in 1924, we set up the design awards to reward the best emerging designers. And I think it's safe to say that this scheme itself in the 90 years has not only mirrored the evolution of design from the traditional industrial arts to actually 21st century's understanding of design, which is design thinking, service design, all of the new models. And so the scheme is really has mirrored that, but also helped to lead that evolution.
And cut to this year, how many categories of awards did you give out?
There were 8 briefs, as we call them, this year, and they are all issue-based. They ranged from a brief about how can we better design the working conditions of the future, to how can design play a role in water scarcity issues, particularly in urban environments, to how can we be more resourceful in developing countries and use frugal innovation.
And the participating students are all UK-based, and are they mainly at design colleges, and what do they win?
So to answer the first part of your question, they're not all UK-based. I'd say about 90% are UK-based, but the competition is open to anyone in the world, and I can talk a little bit about our international work in a moment. And in terms of what they win either a cash prize or...
Oh, yes, please.
Yes. Or an internship. Surprisingly, the internships are a lot more valuable.
Okay.
And those range from design agencies, Pentagram, Springitz, Dragon Rouge, Priestman Good, to places that you might not think that they'd be willing to take a designer, such as water companies, the Environment Agency, the Home Office. These are all places that we've worked with in the past. And they also get 1 year free fellowship of the RSA, in addition to the other work that the RSA does. We're a membership organization, and so it allows access to the building and lots of the other resources that the RSA offers.
And it sounds like a fascinating thing to judge and to look at all the submissions coming in, because presumably designs year on year, decade by decade, especially with such a long history as yours, paint a picture of the state of the world, the state of the nation. What were the preoccupations now, some very environmental and sustainability focused? What were they back in the mid-1920s? Was like, we must have a flying car or something. I mean, I wonder whether you can see people's predilections, the predilections of a society through the designs of the years.
Yes. I mean, I think there has certainly been an element of seeing the way that design has evolved from decorative arts through to a force for social impact. I think I said that earlier. And so we are now seeing young designers who might be trained in graphic design actually use their skills to enter a service design project. We at present are very concerned with the circular economy and cradle-to-cradle manufacturing and how designers can play a more important role in that. A lot of the decisions that affect a product's end of life actually happen early on in the design stage. So that's something we think a lot about.
In terms of the opposite of inbuilt,
yes,
obsolescence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of what those issues were in the 1920s or even in the post-war period.
Sarah's making a face like she might be guessing.
Yeah. I think I'm not going to say anything about that. I will say that some of our most illustrious alumni include Sir Jonathan Ive, Senior Vice President for Design at Apple, who designed some remarkable sort of interface type things back in the 1980s. So we can certainly see a precursor to some of the things that we're so familiar with today.
Well, take us through a couple of the winners this year, what they designed and kind of why they appealed to the judges.
Okay, I'm just going to think quickly. Well, we ran a brief this year together with Waitrose about sustainable packaging. Actually, what is the role of packaging? A lot of packaging goes to waste. How can packaging either be better recycled, or can we use packaging for another use after it's used to carry the goods safely from shop to home, if you were? One student actually looked at the whole issue of paint and paint containers. Short-life paint containers are a surprisingly big issue, the fact that paint dries out quickly after you buy it and paint one thing. So he designed a whole system around how we could have better paint containers, what the branding on that would be, and actually designed a new nozzle system for that. So it doesn't actually sound that exciting probably when I describe it, but the impact on what it would mean for business and for the environment is actually quite huge. And that was a student, Alec Machin, from the University of Nottingham.
And do you hope that these ideas will be picked up by the likes of Waitrose? And is there some appetite on the behalf of those companies to do that?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's growing more and more. So we are finding that, and I often say this when I go to the universities and speak to students, which is that this isn't about a student competition. The way of the world is changing, and the idea that you submit into this might become your career. You might find that you become an entrepreneur developing paint containers, if that's what you choose to do. And we're putting more and more mechanisms in place, mentoring and business support for these students, so that if they appetite is there, they can go on and take these ideas to market.
And do you guys at the RSA have a good relationship with, I mean, you mentioned these internships that people can go and do at these big design firms and things. Do you have a very good relationship with them? Are you sort of a bit of a bridge between the design student and the workplace and the future of design?
Absolutely. So not only a bridge between education and the design industry, but education and the role of design in industry as a whole. So as organizations like the Cabinet Office or the Environment Agency, government organizations and other organizations, as I mentioned before, some water companies that we work with that have never traditionally looked to designers are actually starting to see the value of that by working with us in the Student Design Awards. And so there's something there as organizations seek innovation in new ways that they're looking for emerging designers and the thinking that they bring with them.
That was Sevra Davis, Associate Director of Design at the Royal Society of Arts and also the manager of the Student Design Awards, talking to Andrew Tuck and Robert Bowne there.
Grundig's goal is to bring the best of the world's entertainment into your home. Its digital and DAB Plus radios allow you to access an unlimited choice of broadcasters from around the world and to listen to them with the most superior sound quality. Its new Bluetooth-enabled audio products let you play music from your smartphone. Grundig is committed to making sound crystal clear, whether it's beaming in from the other side of the world or from a mobile right next to you. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging, and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features, and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Now we're at the end of this week's edition of Section D, but before we go, let's look to some of the architectural stories making waves in the States. For our regional focus this week, Alan G. Brake, the executive editor of the Architects newspaper, joins us now from our New York bureau. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Thank you.
Let's get started with an interesting story in Chicago. I mean, architects are not usually one to shy away from making themselves known, but there's a quite interesting story with a new tower that's being developed, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. This week it was announced that what will be the third largest skyscraper, tallest skyscraper in Chicago was unveiled. And this immediately set a lot of speculation about who was the architect for this project. It's quite a dramatic design. It's sort of divisive already. A lot of people are speculating that it's Jeannie Gang from Studio Gang. And no one has been able to confirm that at this point.
Why not? Why do you think she's sort of shying away from announcing this?
It's totally unclear. You know, she's certainly very well known. I think, you know, she won a MacArthur Genius Grant. You know, there was just a big profile of her in The New Yorker. But at the same time, she's not particularly a kind of spotlight-grabbing personality. That being said, it seems clear that there must be some backstory that we just don't know yet.
Because she's also designed a tower nearby, hasn't she, which is the tallest building ever designed by a woman.
Yes, and that makes this particularly interesting because this tower is actually taller than that. So she would be sort of upping herself, essentially.
And it's interesting because, you know, Chicago is the home of the skyscraper historically. Well, how would you describe this building? Is it sort of been well received? It's quite an interesting looking thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite a dramatic design. It sort of cants inward and outward. There's actually kind of three towers that are essentially side by side that sort of form one building. It's a bit hard to describe, actually. You know, she's very well known for structural innovation, but also for environmentally sensitive, particularly tall buildings. So it'll be interesting to kind of learn more about how this building works beyond just, you know, a sort of leaked rendering.
Let's leave Chicago now and head to New York, where you are at the moment, and another new skyscraper there, which is sort of courting controversy.
So this would be the tallest residential tower in the world, and it's actually a foot shorter than One World Trade Center. So it really essentially is the same height as One World Trade. It would actually be taller than what was known as the Sears Tower in Chicago, which was for a long time the tallest building in the West. So this building would actually be taller than that if you don't count the spire of the Sears Tower.
What's the sort of the current state of play with skyscraper architecture at the moment in New York? I mean, you know, building is happening all the time, but is there, in your personal opinion, the imagination and the inventiveness of sort of going up that there used to be, you know, decades ago when New York was sort of developing itself as a high-rise city?
Well, it's changed a lot, and something that's changed quite suddenly is this phenomenon of the super tall, super thin skyscraper, and this is one of those buildings. You know, these are residential buildings, they're often single unit or a duplex situation per floor, you know, catering to the ultra wealthy, super elite buyer. So they've become controversial in many ways, partly because there's an important emerging corridor of them on 57th Street, which is just a couple of blocks from Central Park. And there's a lot of studies about how the shadows from these extremely tall buildings will impact the park. You know, shadows will stretch very deep into New York's iconic Central Park.
And talk to us about the Clark Art Institute, which has got a new expansion. It's owned by Tadao Ando from Japan.
Yes, now this is a really marvelous project. You know, the Clark is one of those very special small museums. It's in Williamstown, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires, which is a very, very beautiful part of the country. And it's always been a kind of hidden gem, a sort of destination museum. And they've taken a very long time to pursue this expansion. It has a kind of funny 1950s classical building, which Annabelle Seldorf has just renovated. And then Tadao Ando has completed this very beautiful gateway building. It has an over 100-acre landscape with it. Reed Hildebrand did the landscape architecture. All three of these very talented designers worked very well together and obviously have a lot of affection for each other from this project. I've seen them speak. They seem like they've all become very close to this project, which I think was about 12 years in the making. So it's really sort of synthesized the experience of viewing art with being in a wonderful landscape and being in, you know, a series of really important, great buildings.
Do you think when a sort of architectural project like this has been developed and honed over such a long time, it kind of affects the end result? You can tell that everything's been, you know, I guess in a very that Japanese way of things being perfected slowly and very sensitively, and actually that's what makes the character of a building rather than something that's a bit more slapdash and beginning and ended in, you know, a couple of years.
Ideally, that's the case. I mean, you also run the risk of something being designed by committee, and that can often dilute a project. That doesn't seem to have been the case here at all. Something that's quite interesting is, you know, Ando is very famous for his use of concrete and glass and the way in which he sort of balances those things, and the finishes that he's able to get on the concrete are very well known, very luminous, incredible sort of materiality. What's interesting here is the director of the museum actually convinced him to use something beyond concrete. So there's a lot of concrete in the building, but there's a very long, very significant red granite wall that sort of cuts through the site almost like a piece of sculpture. That, I'm sure, took Ando a very long time to be convinced to do, and that's something when you're working on a project for 12 years and you develop a lot of trust, those kinds of changes can happen and people's thinking can evolve in interesting ways.
And let's talk about Big Architects has just designed quite a fun little project at the National Building Museum.
Yeah, no, another fun museum story, obviously much more playful than the kind of seriousness of Ando. Bjerk Engels Group, known as Big, has designed this really wonderful maze in the atrium of the National Building Museum, which is an enormous space, and the museum is often challenged with how to fill and activate this space. So this summer they've built what they're calling the Big Maze, which takes over about a third of this very large atrium. And what's really amazing about it is when you enter the maze, you know, you can't see where you're going at all, and then as you move through it, the walls begin to slope down, and once you reach the center, you can begin to look back out, and you can see the maze in its entirety once you're in the center. So it plays some interesting sort of visual tricks as you're moving through it.
Wow.
It's also a great place, I think, if you know you're visiting the museum, you can maybe check your kids in at the maze and have a little time to yourself to maybe take in a more serious exhibition. I think it works very well for families.
Yeah, like sort of Yellow Brick Road. Fantastic. Well, that sounds great. Lovely little summer thing there to visit.
Yeah, no, I'm hoping to make it down to see it myself. Unfortunately, I haven't gotten lost in the maze yet myself, so looking forward to that.
Alan Brake, executive editor of the Architects newspaper, many thanks indeed for running us through some of the stories on the agenda in America. Thanks very much. And finally, let's cross now to Portugal for the last few moments of this week's show. Section D's Ale John is in Lisbon to investigate how housing design and regeneration are two issues at the top of City Hall's agenda. Ale's there right now, putting together a special report for next week's Section D, but he joins us now to give us a little taster of what we can expect. Welcome to the show, Ale.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. So tell us about the trip.
So I've been invited by Lisbon University along with the OiConet group. The OiConet is a global network of universities and research institutions that focuses specifically on housing research and housing design. And so effectively, I am a fly on the wall of the first of three yearly international seminars on the process of housing design and regeneration in the city. And you can imagine it's kind of sharing of good practices and lots of people scratching their chin and nodding and going, yes, that's very important. But it's easy to be kind of snooty about it, but actually they are a lot of the projects which they have already instigated have been going for 4 years or so in Lisbon itself. And we just heard from one of the speakers, who I'll tell you about in a moment, he had some really interesting practical stuff which has been happening for, like I said, over 4 years now. So it isn't just chin scratching and sort of professors thinking about how they can change the city for the better without really consulting any of the residents. It is very much a hands-on, practical kind of atmosphere here in Lisbon.
So what's on the agenda?
Well, today it's seminars and interviews with City Hall professionals, economists, sociologists, architecture professors. But tomorrow is the interesting stuff. I'm going on two field trips to two very different areas. One is a very formal area in its development of mass housing. It's called Portella de Sacavém. And another one is Bairro de Liberdade, a typical neighbourhood of informal, but I have to stress, not illegal, mass housing. Both are examples of neighbourhoods in Lisbon's very varied housing history, which has gone through huge changes since the end of the dictatorial regime in 1974. As Miguel Brito, architect and coordinator of the BIPZIP programme here in Lisbon for the City Hall, told me earlier.
We know that the city and the people who live there were not in the same page on the overall city, so we want to try to understand where are the areas, more deprived areas, on social, economical, environmental and urbanistic situations. And we've made a work inside the municipality and with participatory as a benchmark. And we try to go to the citizens and to some of the areas that we know that were in the bad shape and try to work with them and to understand what are the problems. And one of the things that was important, it was a mentality change, almost in the semantic of it. It was a little...
And it's your perception then?
Yes, the perception of the city and the people themselves that live in deprived areas. And we'd like to pinpoint not the critical image or the bad image with the words, and we want to understand that areas are needing for priority intervention from the public's governance. So it was priority intervention areas or neighborhoods that was the main frame, the main concept of the starting of the work.
As Miguel was saying there, the desired outcome of this project is to develop an evolving housing design model. It's using prefabricated wood panels. This is something which they're going to be doing at the end of the week's activities this week, to readapt pre-existing dwellings to contemporary living patterns and to produce new built homes as a response to today's living conditions. It's a lot of big words and a lot of thinking behind this, but as I said, hopefully by the end of the week we'll be able to see some kind of practical implementation of a lot of the stuff which is being discussed here in Lisbon.
And we look forward to hearing all about it next week. Aled, thank you very much. And I'm afraid that's your lot for this week. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com. if you'd like to hear more. I'm Tom Morris, and to play you out this week, in honour of our regional focus from America, here is America with Horse With No Name.
On the first part of the journey, I was looking at all the life. There were plants and birds and rocks and things. There were sand and hills and rain.
answer. You can't remember your name, 'cause there ain't no one for to give you no pain. Remember your name, 'cause there ain't no one born to give you no pain.